The expression the black market has sinister connotations, a network of illegal businesses that pay no taxes, take advantage of their customers, and compete unfairly with law-abiding businesses. But a new book by Peruvian economist Hernando de Soto says the black market is a different story in third world countries. He offers Peru's black market as a demonstration of the creativity and drive of the disenfranchised. He says a Kafkaesque system of government regulations has kept the poor out of the legal business world, so they operate illegally, but they're frequently more efficient than their legitimate counterparts. De Soto is president of the Institute for Liberty and Democracy, which has researched the flourishing black market systems in housing, transportation, manufacturing, and sales in Lima, Peru, a city of 6 million. He reports his findings in his new book, The Other Path, The Invisible Revolution in the Third World. The introduction was written by Peruvian novelist Mario Vargas Llosa. The book is a bestseller in Peru and in several other Latin American countries. De Soto is an entrepreneur and former managing director of Peru's Central Reserve Bank. De Soto began studying the black market, or what he calls the informal market, because he didn't think existing theories adequately explained the causes of underdevelopment in Peru.
The informal sector to me was interesting because it's another way for saying the illegal sector. It's all about the people who work outside the law. Informality is a euphemism for illegality. And when we measured it and found out that over 60% of Peruvians work outside the law, we said, well, surely this is an indication or a road that can lead us to the solution of why people do not work productively. And in effect it was, because we found that the law was the culprit, that people are forced to work outside the law because the law does not allow for enterprise, does not allow for the kind of freedom and coordination that is required to produce wealth.
Well, before we get to how the law forces people to work outside of it, let me ask you why you use the euphemism of informal instead of calling it a black market or an underground market, an illegal market.
Because we do not want it to be identified with criminality, which is also outside the law. That's why we define informality as illegal means to achieve legal objectives. In other words, I do not obey regulations, statutes, and law, but with the purpose of doing what everybody else is doing, building a home, manufacturing, agriculture, selling, as opposed to, for example, drug trafficking, which is breaking the law, but with illegal objectives, that is to say, with criminal objectives. So what we want to people to understand is that when we talk about the informal sector, we're referring to an enormous part of the population which, just like your Boston Tea Party, worked outside the law but for good purposes.
Through your organization, the Institute for Liberty and Democracy, you've basically deployed a lot of college students to study both how the legal entrepreneurial system works in Peru and how the informal system, the underground system works. You had your college students try to start a legal store and a legal factory and see how much of the, you know, red tape and bureaucratic stuff they had to go through to start it. Give us an example of what was required to start a store, going through the bureaucratic procedures in Lima.
Well, first of all, what we did was, instead of taking the lawyer's word of how much time it took, was to measure it, as you say, in fact, sending college students out window of the bureaucracy to fulfill the red tape requirements. And this involved going to a variety of different offices and getting different type of seals and documents filled in. The result is that in terms of the store, it was something like about 45 days of red tape, working 8 hours a day. And in terms of the industry, which really were only two sewing machines with which to actually sew shirts and clothes, it took us 289 days working 6 hours a day.
What was some of the work that you had to do for those 289 days?
The work we had to do for those 289, it involved visiting different government offices. First of all, the Ministry of Industry, then the Ministry of Trade, then the Ministry of Norms, then the municipality, then county offices. And in 10 opportunities, we were solicited bribes, and we tried not to pay them. But in two occasions, we had no other solution, unless we wanted to interrupt the study, than to pay the bribes. Otherwise, we couldn't have gotten ahead. Now, what's interesting, of course, is we've done the same experiment in New York to find out how much time it takes to register two sewing machines that could be called a clothing workshop in New York, and it took us 4 hours. In other words, a Peruvian businessman, and probably many Latin Americans and third worlders, to start off on a business, that is to say, making it legal, making it acceptable, to society and the government in special, will work 700 times more than a U.S. entrepreneur. And that, in our eyes, said a lot of why we Latin Americans are poorer than North Americans.
It also means you already have to have a lot of money to start a business because you have to fund yourself through the bureaucratic process.
That's right. In other words, what we're trying to say is that there are no market or free market systems in Latin America, that people can do enterprise, but it's generally those people who have the resources and the time or the knowledge or the power to do so and not common people.
Okay, let's look at what you call the informal system, or what would also be known as the black market system. There's an enormous diversity of vendors in Peru operating without licenses. Give us a sense of the extent of that. Is there a percentage that you have, the amount of businesses or vendors that are illegal, unlicensed?
Yes, well, vendors, of course, are but the tip of the iceberg, because they're actually the minority of the informal sector, but they're, of course, the more visible one because you catch them on the streets. They're a nuisance for other people, a convenience for some, of course, but a nuisance in general. In Lima, there's 90,000 street vendors, and they account for about 60%, for example, of the sales of food. They're a very small part of the picture. What's interesting, of course, is that they are also the biggest builders of markets in Peru. We ended up by counting the amount of markets that existed in Lima, produce markets, and there were 331. Of these 331 markets, 278 had been built by former street vendors. So street vendors don't like staying on the street. You know, streets don't allow you to accumulate inventory. It's not very hygienic. You don't really have property rights over the sidewalk. So they like to move on to markets. It's not that people generally like being in the street. It's that most of them don't have another alternative.
A lot of illegal businesses sell goods that have been smuggled illegally. Is that the case with the informal system in Peru? Where do the goods come from that are being sold?
Oh, well, many of them come from the formal sector. They're quite legal.
Uh-huh.
They're produced by manufacturers. It's simply that it's more competitive to sell them on the sidewalk. It's more convenient for a lot of people. And, of course, they do sell some of the smuggled goods, but not generally on the street. These are very specifically... these are in Lima, at least, they're very specifically located sectors of street vendors. As a matter of fact, most of the ones that are government protected, because those that are government protected or have been established there under political aegis or as part of a political program, feel sufficiently secure that they are able to pass on smuggled goods. But it's not the generality of cases, because the police would persecute them.
Why does the state allow the illegal vendors to operate? Why do the police turn their heads?
Because there's so many of them. If you figure that 60% of more than 60% of Peruvian man hours worked, and that's probably true, as I said, for Latin America and maybe most of the third world, happened to be illegally employed, the police would be spending all their time persecuting 60% of the population. That's just too many people to persecute. No government would be able to stand after a while. So they have to turn their heads. You see, informality or black markets have ceased to be a marginal phenomenon. The marginals are we people who live on the legal side of the fence. That means to say that they're the majority, and they may be illegal or informal in economic terms, but politically they vote. You can't go around chasing your voters.
My guest is Hernando de Soto, who's written a new book analyzing how the black market operates in Peru. And from that, he's drawn an analysis of why the economies of many third world countries have failed, and he says that the real free market system hasn't been given a chance, but the informal, the illegal markets are prospering because they don't have to deal with the bureaucracy of the state. Now, as you said, that the vendors are just the tip of the iceberg in this underground system. There's a system of housing, of transportation, of manufacturing, and of commerce. Let's look at the housing system briefly. There are whole illegal communities that you say have established a new system of property rights. Can you give us an example of what one of these communities looked like and how it was established?
Well, they look like most of the other Latin American communities. To give you an idea of the proportions of what we're talking about, half of Lima has been built illegally. You have a city of 6 million people, and that means that about 3 million of them live in homes that have been initiated illegally.
What does that mean?
Illegally means without anybody's rights. They're probably on government land that they've just simply taken by force in groups of 40,000, 100,000, 10,000, 1,000, 300 people have massively gone in there. They've created a sufficiently large critical mass that they have been able to establish themselves there against authorities, pretty much the same way you did it in the days of the Far West or in California during the Gold Rush. They just took over the land and they squatted on it. Most, about half of Latin American cities have probably been built illegally. So that's how big it is. Today, as a matter of fact, of every 10 buildings being built in Peru, 7 are being built illegally. So it's not something that's passed away. It's a growing phenomenon. What these communities look like is they start off by being straw houses being made of straw matting or cardboard or corrugated iron or old wood, just like any shanty town, and gradually they build up into cement and bricks and iron and get to 2 stories and 3 stories, and after 20 years they look pretty much like the rest of our houses, if they've had luck and if their property rights have not been challenged too harshly.
Now, since there are so many of these large illegal communities around Peru, there's become a whole transportation system, a whole underground transportation system to link them.
That's right. We have tried to figure out how many of the people in the transport business are informal. And if you take the buses, it's about 90% of the buses are informal, are illegal. Mm-hmm. The rest are cooperatives and state-managed corporations. State management corporations are about 5% of the buses. But if you include taxis in the business, then 95% of public transport in the city of Lima is informal. So that gives you also an idea of the extent of illegality in that kind of public service.
Now, I think in many countries, whenever there's a prospering black market or illegal system, it tends to be dominated by organized crime. Mobsters move in and try to control the market that they've created. Mm-hmm. And in order to get your share in it, you have to make payoffs and you have to be beholden to the dons of the organized crime system. Mm-hmm. Is there something like that happening in the informal system that you're describing in Lima?
Well, we suppose so, because once in a while one does come up with some news in the papers that somebody has been abusing power, but we haven't actually encountered it directly. And the reason for that is that the informal sector is wide enough so that, in fact, they have their own rules. And their own rules are based on consensus. They're democratic. And since nobody in the informal sector has his own police force or army, it's very difficult to impose one's wills on some on other people. And the way we figured that out is that the reason why in Western society sometimes mafias and criminals impose themselves in the black market is probably because they use government to do it. That is to say, they've bought out somebody who's got power in the private sector, which, as you know, has a monopoly on weapons, or close to a monopoly on weapons, or an oligopoly on weapons, and that's the reason why they're able to impose authority. In the case of the informal sector, there's no way that you can impose your authority. You just have to be consensual. And the reason, what we have found, on the contrary, are large democratic institutions, informal, of course, common law governments, but very little violence and nearly no mafiosi. Mm-hmm. It's a wide enough sector. And, of course, because they're out of touch with formal power, which is what gives you the right to exploit other people.
I think one of the main points in your book is that many Westerners think that capitalism is failing in third world countries, but it's not failing. It's just that it's never really been given a chance. True capitalism, true free market systems have never really existed. Yes?
Yes, this is correct. I think the mistake is actually one that must be corrected as soon as possible. There's a feeling that because you have private enterprise in Latin America and it's not working, that capitalism has failed or that market economies have failed. But in fact, you see, capitalism has had various stages. One of the first stages in history has been mercantilism. It was a time back in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, even in so many countries all the way through the 19th and beginning of the 20th centuries in the West, that capitalism was reserved for those who were close to political power. As a matter of fact, the only way you could engage on large business in the old days in Britain was to obtain a charter from the king. The rest of us would have to have worked through the guilds. So capitalism wasn't democratic and it wasn't open. It wasn't an opportunity for everybody. And that's what's actually been working in Latin America. It's an area where you've got to know how to deal with power and with regulations, and you've got to have good political contacts to actually be able to survive in business, at least if it's a large business. So what is failing now in Latin America is mercantilism. And now has come, as the informals invade the market, the opportunity to actually break that system and have real capitalism, modern capitalism, come into being.
It seems to me that in a way, you're fighting for the souls of the poor, fighting with the communists over the souls of the poor. And you're saying that that the poor and the disenfranchised in third world countries are frequently great entrepreneurs if given the chance in the black market, and that therefore they should have an investment in capitalism instead of in communism.
Well, that's it. And I think there's plenty of examples all the way around the world. The way we see it, there's a chapter in the book that's called The Mercantilist Parallel, with reference especially to Europe, is that that's what happened in Europe. I mean, Oliver Twist coming into London was an informal coming to London. The poor laws were all about trying to keep him out of London. And it's only as the large pressure from migrations in Europe imposed upon the Western the change of their institutions and letting Oliver Twist also become an entrepreneur and not just a marginal dependent of the Swiss system, that you started getting the open societies that today flourish. In those countries which resisted opening up, like Eastern Europe, like Russia, the mercantilism took another form, which is communism. In other words, certain people had a different interpretation of what was going on. They said that this was an exploited proletariat, and the only way of actually fighting an unjust system was doing communism. The same thing has probably been happening in Asia in the course of the last 40 years. When the mass migrations occurred in China, you had societies like Hong Kong and South Koreans, which opened up and let everybody come inside the system and use their individual entrepreneurship. You had other societies, such as Vietnam, where on the contrary, authorities clamped down on the black markets and corruption thrived. And of course, the communism had ethical and superior hand. We think the same thing is happening in Latin America today. And that's why it's very important not only for us, but also for you, to realize that you have to make a distinction in private enterprise. There are two people that are for private enterprise, King George III on the one hand, and the Boston Tea Party. But the difference is that the Boston Tea Party believes that everybody should have a right to private enterprise without political interference. And what we're telling you is that the Boston Tea Party in Latin America is the black market.
You say in your book that you think that the communists patronize workers, and I'd like you to explain what you mean.
Well, what happens with the communists in Latin America is that they attend the calls of the poor. Their interpretation of what's going on, of course, is also erroneous. But at least they've got their pulse, they've got their hands on the pulse of the poor. They're trying to help them. But in fact, their analysis doesn't totally apply to what's happening in Latin America. For example, their whole interpretation of poverty in Latin America revolves around the fact that there is a large exploited proletarian class that's given undue wages. And our statistics show that, as a matter of fact, probably less than 5% of Latin Americans are proletariat, that is to say, blue-collar workers, that are unionized. The majority of Latin Americans are budding entrepreneurs. But since the communists are the only ones who pay attention to the problems of poverty, who reach out to people who are outside the law, even though their interpretation is long, they have an upper hand. What we're saying is that those people who sympathize with free markets, who sympathize with entrepreneurship and with democracy, should learn that the people that they generally consider their interlocutors, the people they dialogue with in Latin America, in many cases are the King Georges of Latin America. That your real interlocutors are the Boston Tea Parties, which I repeat are the underground economy. And that is much better class analysis than the communists have been able to provide so far. So if you actually do go out and touch the underground, which is what we're recommending Latin American Democrats to do, and if the U.S. foreign policy and in Western organizations do the same thing, you have got better class analysis and a much better chance at avoiding future Nicaraguas and Cubas and Vietnams.
Would it be correct to say that you're worried that if the government doesn't change its marketing system, and if it doesn't get rid of some of the bureaucracy, that you think that in your country there's bound to be either a communist revolution or a military coup?
Well, yes, these things are normal. I mean, it is happening throughout the third world. As these mercantilist systems, which is a tight bureaucratic control over the economy, which generally favors those who are organized to take power or to work with power, as when these systems start weakening or crumbling, there's only two options to replace them. You either open up the system or you close it even further with a totalitarian dictatorship, which supposedly has a wider support. This is what's happened in Cuba. This is what's happened in Nicaragua. This is what some people are trying to make happen in El Salvador and now in Peru. So it's a question at this moment of not only getting rid of the bureaucracy, but actually changing the whole political system. Because you see, there's another myth. It's not only that free markets haven't ever been given a chance in Latin America, even democracy hasn't been given a chance. You see, you have a tendency, like we do, to confuse democracy with elections. elections, as somebody said in the United States some time ago, are the most entertaining form of government. But you also have elections in the Soviet Union. So elections are not democracy. They're only a beginning to democracy. Democracy is also about how you make rules. It's all about accountability. It's whether your courts allow you to protect yourself from the abuses of central government. It's about access to public information. It's about enfranchisement. And all of these other things that I've just mentioned now are not working in Latin America. So what you have in Latin America are electoral systems, and electoral systems aren't enough to be able to listen to people. You've got to have people participating in government, and that just doesn't work in most of Latin America.
Even though you're suggesting peaceful changes in the economic system, you still would be asking people who have power and have influence to give up some of it, or at least to share it, which isn't that frequently doesn't come naturally to
people who have a lot of power. But you see, that's what's interesting about the appearance of the informals on the scene. You see, back after the Second World War, what's happened is that the informals were really yesterday's peasants. Now, yesterday's peasants before the Second World War were spread out in the hinterland of Latin America. They were spread out in small little villages which had no political clout. As a matter of fact, they were the paradise of anthropologists in National Geographic magazine. They were supposed to be the other side of the Latin Americans, which didn't want to integrate a Western-type economy. Well, all of these people have moved to the cities, at least in a great extent. Latin American cities have quintupled between the end of the Second World War, say 1946-47, and today. So all those ignorant peasants are today savvy city dwellers who are demanding their rights and who are unsatisfied, who have passed from resentment to violence to aggression to creating large black markets, and they're shaking up the system. So all we're doing is providing a diagnosis. We're saying that these people are now not accepting the status quo, are voting in many cases extensively to the left, are sometimes joining guerrillas and terrorists, and are a potentially volatile mass of human beings. So the pressure to actually make people change and share power is enormous. If people who believe in capitalism and believe in democracy, instead of reaching towards these people and agreeing that you have to change things radically in Latin America, on the contrary, call for the stabilization of the system, for a preservation of the status quo, you're only allowing these people to reach towards communist arguments in case they want to change it. What we're proposing is a revolutionary capitalism. What we're trying to tell the informals and all those who sympathize with them is that the only way to change things is not the Marxist-Leninist route. You also have the capitalist route and the democratic route. In other words, it's not that markets have failed and democracy have failed in Latin America. It's that they still yet have to be established, and that in itself is a revolutionary program. And that's why you have the title of book called The Other Path, as opposed to, in Peru, The Shining Path, which is the communist solution.
So what kind of path do you recommend? In other words, what kind of changes do you think could actually be made? Slow changes, evolutionary changes, as opposed to revolution?
Well, to start off with, we don't believe in slow changes. We believe in rapid, radical changes. And we don't believe they have to be evolutionary. We also believe they have to be revolutionary. Now, those changes start off, first of all, with good rulemaking procedures. In Peru, laws and rules are made out of the imagination of the people who rule. We make, at the central government level, which would be equivalent to your federal level, 27,000 rules a year. That means 111 rules per working day. And 99% of those rules are made by the executive branch without any accountability, without any possibility of a Peruvian to be able to seriously challenge those rules when they come out. In other words, we really have elections, and we elect a dictatorship every 5 years. Now, until that changes, Peruvians will not feel identified with democracy and will think that it's failing. What we're saying is that the first radical change there has to be is the rulemaking procedure. And that involves, of course, a series of other complementary changes. For example, access to public information. Any North American can get information from public sources of information. He can go to government and find out why it is that a rule has been adopted, but at least the press can, and then comment upon it or criticize it. At least he can find out what the reasoning is behind any proposed rule. Well, in my country, for example, there not only isn't any facilities for public information, but the access to it is forbidden by law. And the courts, of course, also don't allow you to sue government, except in Lima, and even government doesn't have to testify. And it's a lengthy procedure, which government will probably win because they also name the judges directly. So all the mechanisms that are really needed for people to participate in government decisions and influence government in the way that they are to be governed do not exist in Latin America. And these are the basis of a working and successful democracy. So the first changes we would have to make are those that would allow us not only to elect our governments, but also to make them accountable to us and to allow us to participate in the making of the rules. None of that has to be evolutionary. We should be able to do that overnight. There's plenty of examples in the Western world and even in the informal sector where rules are transparent as opposed to a closed society, as is in Peru and most of Latin America.
Your book, The Other Path, has been a bestseller in Peru. Do you think it's having any effects on how the government operates or on how businesses are licensed?
Well, what's interesting is that it was the number one bestseller in Peru. It's actually, I think, the most sold book in the history of Peru, and it's been a number one bestseller in most Latin American countries. It was an indication to us that most Latin American countries have actually problems similar to ours. It's already beginning to have effect because many informals are getting organized under the banners of the book. And as a matter of fact, are focusing now most of their protest or their petition rights on the law rather than on vague political objectives. The last informal strikes in Peru, which involved more people than there are those organized in trades union, were called the strikes of the other path. So it's already beginning to have influence, yes.